You are listening to the Mid-Current Church Podcast. Today's message is week 2 in our teaching series, I Do. For more information and to visit us online, check out midcurrentchurch.org and find us on Facebook and Instagram. And now, here is Pastor Sten Carlson with today's message.
I'm curious if you ever stop to think about why certain combinations or why certain pairings of food seem acceptable and yet others don't. Like, how did peanut butter and jelly? If I could ask God one question someday, I'd be going, how did peanut butter and jelly become the universally accepted food pairing? But like peanut butter in almost anything else feels too weird and gross. For example, Erica's uncle from Pennsylvania, my wife Erica, her uncle from Pennsylvania will tell you how fondly he remembers that growing up eating peanut butter and pickle sandwiches. She texted him just this week, I kid you not, to see, like, A, is this real? B, is this, like, still a thing? And he responded to her, and I quote, he said, "Yuppers, it's the bomb." That sounds really gross to me, but apparently it's a real thing. So is peanut butter and banana, which I actually am okay with. But again, why? Why is this one okay? Why jelly and banana? Maybe that got a response out of some of you. Why jelly and banana, but not pickles, right? Same thing goes for other food combos. I remember growing up, I had a friend, if I, you know, spent the night at his house and woke up the next morning, I'd see he was lactose intolerant. And so instead of pouring milk onto his cereal, he used orange juice. And it made me want to gag. It's such an unlikely pairing. But again, why? Why is it? And what made milk the good pairing? What made, you know, how did milk get the monopoly on the cereal? What is it that makes those two work together? Last one here. What about when you think about pizza? Who likes ranch dressing on their pizza? There's a few hands going up. Who thinks that's just gross? Anybody? Okay, there's a few more hands going up. What about honey and pizza crust? Anyone? On that one, when Erica and I lived for a few years in Colorado, we were first introduced to the idea of a pizza place out there called Bojo's. We were first introduced to the idea of dipping our pizza crust in honey. And it seemed like an odd pairing at first to two, like, Chicago transplants. It almost felt a little disrespectful to the pizza pie. But it kind of grew on us. And now all our whole family, kids and all five of us, like dipping pizza crust into honey. Who would have thought? Okay, it is hard to know when two things are going to make a good combination. It's hard to know if mixing two unique ingredients together, it's hard to know if it's going to work out at all or if it's going to totally backfire. And I think the same thing is true. I think the same thing goes for a whole lot more than food. In fact, I think one of the most unlikely and the most risky pairings and combinations ever experimented with is the marriage relationship. Right? Listen to how the marriage relationship is described by Jesus in the New Testament book of Matthew. The religious leaders are getting into a discussion with Jesus about marriage, and he reminds everybody listening of what he thought many of them would know to be true from the Old Testament scriptures long ago. Here's what he says. You can see it on the side screens. Jesus enters into this discussion. He says, "Haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female? And he said, for this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and get this, the two will become one flesh, so they are no longer two, but one." Okay, man plus woman, no longer two, but in fact just one, right? It's one plus one that somehow magically, mysteriously still equals one. Okay, according to my calculations, this is like the most ultimate, the most beautiful, the most powerful, and the most unique, daring, risky, and unlikely of combinations in history. Why? Because as we learned last week, as we kicked off this series, if you were here, if you caught up online, as we learned last week, not that it was a huge shock, but we learned the first week of this series, I do, that men and women are different, like really different, right? That's what makes this marriage deal such an unlikely pairing and combination. We're different. The good news that we discovered last week is that we're different by design. Our differences did not catch God off guard. His plan for the marriage relationship was not destroyed upon learning that we were different from one another. That was the plan. We were created different on purpose for a purpose. That's the good news. The bad news is that it doesn't guarantee. It doesn't guarantee that this pairing works. You can't just set it and forget it, right? Just because God had a good plan in the beginning, it doesn't mean that we don't have to do our part actively every day along the way, right? The truth is marriage will work if we are willing to work at it. And so the question that I want to try to answer today is one that seems, you know, mathematically impossible. It almost seems like relationally impossible. The question I want to answer is, how in the world does two become one? How does that work? How is that possible? How does two become one? I want to try to answer this question. What do we need to do? What do we need to know? What do we need to understand in order to pull off this most risky combination of all time, riskier than peanut butter and pickles? How do we do it? How does two actually become one? Okay, that is my goal in the second week of this series called I Do. And I'm sure you can tell by this intro or by the title of the series that we are spending a few weeks talking about marriage and how we can strengthen the marriages of which we are a part or build a solid understanding of marriage from the ground up. And before we keep going, I just want to acknowledge, I did this last week, I want to do it again. I just want to acknowledge before we keep going that I recognize that not everyone here is married. I get that, right? And so if you're not, you might be tempted to like check out, like, okay, great, you know? And if that's the case, here's what I want to say. Here's my humble request. Don't do that. Don't check out, right? The truth is some of you you're not married now, but you might be someday. And so the stuff that we're talking about is going to help you now build a really solid framework and a really solid foundation for the marriage relationship that you might be in someday. Others of you, you might not be married and you might not ever be married for a number of different reasons. But here's what I think is true. You might already or you will maybe someday play a really vital role of support in the marriage of friends and family that are close to you. And so I think this conversation, as you stand alongside of them, I think this conversation is still so good and so relevant for you to be a part of. The second thing I just want to make sure I remind you of is the fact that marriage is not the mark of success in the world. Marriage is not the mark of success in the church. You're not a second-class citizen if you're not yet married. That's not what this message, that's not what the message I want this whole series to send. And the last thing I want to add too is that I recognize that some of you, I don't know, maybe you've recently gone through or you're currently going through maybe a painful season of marriage or a painful end of a marriage. And this series is not intended to, add any extra, message of shame or guilt or anything onto you. In fact, if that is you right now, we'd love to support you in any way we could. We'd love to be praying for you and standing alongside you in any way that we could that might be helpful. But what I did want to do, right? I still did want to carve out some time this month to talk about marriage like this, because we do have a lot of married couples here. Marriage is so vital, and yet it can be a real challenge too. And so I wanted to take some time to talk about how it is that our marriages will thrive the way that God intended them to, which brings us right back to where I began. It brings us right back to God's intention that in this marriage relationship that two would become one. How does this happen? on so many different levels. It almost feels like this is not possible, like it's oil and water, right? That there's no possible way that mixing these two unique ingredients, there's no way that it could work. There's no way that the two could become one, right? Well, the truth is it is possible. And it is what God intended, and it is what God designed for the marriage relationship. And so here's, as I keep going here, here's what I want to suggest to you all today. In order for two to become one, which is possible and which is God's design for this deal we call marriage, in order for two to become one, there must be a death. Excited yet? You're glad you came out here for this one today, right? You're like, oh boy, I thought it was bad enough. Okay, don't get too worried, right? The truth is, for two to become one, there has to be a death. But don't get too worried. It's not a doom and gloom message. It's not going to be dark and the whole deal. But we do need to realize, and we do need to embrace the reality that something does have to die if our marriages are going to live and are going to thrive as God intended them to. So then, what is it? What is it that needs to die? And why should any of us volunteer for it in the first place? That's what I want to try to answer for all of you, for all of us today. To do so, we are going to turn our attention to the book of 1 Corinthians. In the New Testament, this book is actually just a letter that a guy named Paul, he's one of the first ever church leaders, it's a letter that he wrote to Jesus' followers in the city of Corinth, and we're going to turn to chapter 13, 1 Corinthians 13. We're going to turn to that chapter in the letter that he wrote. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, 1 Corinthians 13, why does that sound so familiar? I feel like I've heard someone reference or read from 1 Corinthians 13 before. You probably have. In fact, if you have ever attended a wedding in your life, there is a 99.9999999 chance that the pastor or the bride's Aunt Martha read from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Okay, this is like the classic passage about love in the New Testament. But to be clear, this is actually not a passage about romantic love, right? That the Bible actually has about four ways to describe the various forms of love. There's eros, which is the kind of the romantic, the passionate kind of love. There's philia, which is the kind of love that exists between friends. It's the brotherly love, right? Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Then there's also storge, which is the kind of love that a parent has for a child. And then there's agape love, which is the highest form of love, a love that is completely of God and from God, sometimes described as the love that God has for his people, as well as the reciprocal love that people have for him and that they have for one another. And the famous wedding verses of 1 Corinthians 13, they're actually referring to, they use the agape form of love. That's the word that's used, agape. But here's why I think that they are still read so often at weddings. Right? Because the marriage relationship is often used as kind of a picture to describe the kind of love that God has for his people. The love that, you know, from the beginning, right? The love that the God of Israel had for the people of Israel, it is considered to be the model for the type of love that exists in a marriage. Right? So no, 1 Corinthians 13 is not talking about the kind of romantic love that we might think exists in a marriage, but it is the kind of love that a marriage cannot exist without. Okay? Eros kind of love might create kind of the spark in a marriage, but agape love, the kind of love that is from God and of God, and the kind of love that resembles the unmerited, gracious love of God, that is constantly seeking the benefit of the one that he loves, that is the kind of love that will sustain a marriage. And that's why we need to understand what it's saying. So here is how that kind of love is described in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. It says this, love is patient and love is kind. All of your eyes just rolled into the back of your head. You're like, okay, here we go again, right? Don't roll your eyes yet. I know you've heard this before, but keep listening closely. Love is patient. Love is kind. It says love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. Then listen to this. This is what I want you to hear today. It says this about love, that it does not demand its own way. It's patient. It's kind. It's not jealous. It's not boastful, proud, or rude. And it does not demand its own way. The literal translation of this is just a short little phrase. It's a Greek verb and it's a pronoun. It's the negative form of the verb to seek along with the pronoun itself. That's the very literal translation. The negative form of the verb to seek along with the pronoun itself. So it's saying that the highest form of love demonstrated by God that is to be the model for the marriage relationship in many ways, it does not seek itself. Okay? It is not about itself. It is not looking out for itself. It is not primarily concerned about itself, but rather it is most concerned with the object of its love. It does not demand its own way. It does not seek itself. So Mid-Current, this is it right here. Here's what we see. Here's what it is that has to die. This is what I want to share with you today. Here's what has to die in order for two to become one. Me has to die. Why? So that we can win. Okay? In the marriage relationship that is so important, me has to die so that we can live and win and thrive and work together. Me has to die so that we can win. You could also say it like this, that mine has to die so that ours can win. It is the only way, in my estimation, it is the only way that two separate, different, unique individuals can become one. Something has to die, right? And what we see here is that me has to die so that we can win. I learned this very lesson in my own marriage. My wife, Erica, she used to hate getting into an argument with me or, you know, a conflict with me because she felt like no matter what, she felt like I would always win, okay? And it wasn't necessarily because I was always right. She just felt like I could always, like, talk better. She's like, you talk for a living, right? She's like, she felt like I could talk better and argue better and articulate better for no other reason than just like a more, you know, robust oral argument. She's like, you always win. Right? And Erica got to a place where she would admit that it's like she's even hesitant to like discuss any varying ideas or opinions or arguments because in her mind, it didn't matter. She would lose, right? So she wasn't even interested in getting going at it. Now, early on in our marriage, I don't think I saw this as like a huge problem. I mean, after each argument, I kind of like congratulate myself, yeah, with another victory and like proudly put another check in the win column, like still undefeated, 25-0, undisputed champ, still going strong. And some of you are going like, man, that sounds amazing. I got to learn Sten's ways of, you know, marital conflict and guaranteed victory because that sounds great, right? Who doesn't want to win? Sounds too great. Well, maybe it was for a while, but eventually, here's the honest to God truth. Here's what I started to realize. Every time I would win, we would lose. Every time I would win, which apparently unbeknownst to me was like every time, you win every time, right? Every time I would win, we, the two of us, our marriage, our relationship, right? We would lose. Every time a discussion or a conflict or whatever ended in victory for me, our relationship would, you know, it's like we take one step back, right? Our connection would loosen. Our communication would falter, right? Our partnership would take a hit, right? And so I had to remind myself, I had to learn, right? I still have to remind myself today. I got to remind myself that me winning is not worth us losing. It's not worth it. I kid you not, I got to the place where I would sometimes like start to like defeat my own point of view, right? In an argument, right? I could see all of a sudden, I could see that Erica was getting discouraged, and I could see that ultimately I realized like, oh no, man, we are losing. And so when Erica would start to concede victory to me in clear discouragement, I'd started to turn my own articulation and oral precision against myself. I mean, I'd start to like poke holes in my own argument. Like, well, hold on a second here, right? I mean, I can't be that, you know, right on this thing. If I noticed that she was struggling to, you know, find the words to disagree with me, I'd help her to find the words to tell me why I was wrong. I'd be like, come on, hang in there. Don't go down without a fight. I mean, I don't think I'm right on this one, the more that I think about it. Me winning was not worth us losing. Now, I'm not saying that every conversation, I'm not, saying that every, hard decision that we had to make or every dilemma or I'm not saying every disagreement ended with like a perfectly tied bow on top. But what we have learned and maybe what I have learned most in the course of our almost 15 years of marriage this year, what I've learned is that me has to die so that we, the two of us, so that we can win. It is the only way for two, in my estimation, it is the only way for two to become one. Love does not seek itself. It does not demand that it gets its own way. Maybe you've been coming to that same conclusion in your own marriage, or I don't know, maybe the scales are, falling from your eyes right now here as we speak here today, and you're going, oh my goodness, right, this is what's happening, right? Maybe you're coming to that conclusion. If so, right, if you winning in your mind, if you're realizing, man, me winning is not worth us losing, if that's the case, here's what I want to encourage you to start doing this week, to start doing on the drive home, to start doing as soon as you can. Here's what I want to start encouraging you to do. As often as you can, fight to make we, ours, and us more of a priority in more places in your life and in your marriage. Right? As often as you can, everywhere you can, make we, ours, and us the priority that you have for the important parts of your life in your marriage. In fact, I wanted to stop and ask you right now, before you head out of here in a million different directions, I want to ask you right now to take a minute to think about where we, ours, and us could be or needs to be more of a priority in your marriage right now. Where is it? Where does we, ours, and us need to be more of a priority? I can think of a few that I would suggest. Right, some of you, I don't know, this is maybe you, it's maybe not you. Some of you, you need to make we, ours, and us more of a priority in your financial life together. And I'll just for a second here, I'm gonna get real practical and real direct here for a second. Some of you, and this might not be you, but some of you need to start a joint checking and savings account. You need to scrap the separate accounts and you need to combine them all into one. Now, let me be very clear. No, the Bible does not say that. There's no commandment that says like, thou shalt have jointeth checking accounts. I'll be clear with you. It doesn't say that. So maybe I'm skating on thin ice here. I don't know. Doesn't say anything about that, but it does say the two have to become one, and it does say that love does not look out, you know, like after itself only. So in my opinion, there is no better, there is no practical, there is no everyday way. There's no better way to demonstrate the mystery and the beauty of two becoming one than by making your finances one. Right? That's what's yours is hers and what's hers is yours. I don't know a better way for we to win than for you to win together with your money and your finances and your financial world. To be on the same team with money, to curate dreams and goals and plans together with money, to work together with money, no matter how unfair or unequal it might be. Friends, the truth is there's no better way to lose. There's no better way to lose in marriage. There's no better way to breed comparison and jealousy and resentment and distrust and suspicion and judgment than to keep things separate. Than to have everybody, you know, having both of you kind of looking at the other with concern and suspicion, right? There's no better way to lose together than to keep lives apart from one another, right? So make we, ours, and us more of a priority. And here's one more thing I'm gonna say just when it comes to your finances and a marriage that sometimes drive me nuts. Oftentimes I'll see couples that do have joint accounts, and that's great, right? It's not in the Bible, but right, it's still great here. So oftentimes I see couples that do have joint accounts. But there's something really funky that's going on, right? One will work outside of the house and the other won't work outside of the house. Let's just say, right, traditionally speaking, whatever. Let's say it's the husband that works and the wife that doesn't. Here's what I see from people and that I rub shoulders with. Here's what I see sometimes that drives me nuts. If in this scenario, right, if it's the wife that, you know, isn't working outside of the house, she'll feel like she's, you know, like, I hear this. I see this from people. I have conversations. It'll be like the wife who feels like she's got to get, like, you know, permission to kind of spend money in a certain way, or like, you know, like she doesn't have as much say over, you know, over the direction of, you know, the marriage and the financial, the decisions that we're making. Why? Well, because she's not making the money. So she got to come kind of tiptoe into like, well, you know, do I get a say in this? And I just want to say as politely as I can, that's so dumb. If you want to win personally with money, if you want to keep the upper hand, and you want to be in control and be the only one to, you know, kind of pull all the levers and make all the decisions, then by all means keep this up, make me the priority, go for it. But just realize, I'm telling you right now, that we is going to lose, right? We is probably losing right now. I guarantee if you ask your spouse about a scenario like this, if they're on the other end of it, I guarantee they'll tell you that we is taking a big hit over stuff like this. No better way. No better way than with our pocketbooks. There's no better way to demonstrate the beauty and the mystery and the power of two becoming one. Others of you, I don't know. Others of you, if I'm getting honest here, I guess. Others of you, right? Others of you, you need to make we, ours, and us more of a priority in your sexual and your intimate life together, right? You gotta, if you're uncomfortable about it, you gotta start figuring out a way to get comfortable talking openly and honestly about the needs and the goals and the dreams and the desires you have together for your life in this area together. Right, you got to get comfortable talking about the dreams and the goals and the needs for us, right? If each of you just fight for your own needs, if it's like retreat back to your corner and then come out swinging again, it ain't going to work. Right? If you're just fighting for your own needs, scraping and clawing to get your needs met, it's more likely that you're going to start losing real quick in this scenario. If that's the way you're fighting for yourself, like hypothetically speaking, if I just had to pick one of the two, for example, I don't know, if I had to pick, let's just say it's the husband. I don't know. Let's just pick. Well, just for example here. Right, if the husband's, it could be either, I'm just picking one. If the husband's biggest concern is just getting his needs met, right? You're winning in that area. I'm willing to bet the wife is saying, hey, sure, honey, you might be winning, but we are losing. This is not working in a way that is best for us. So figure out how to, it's different, maybe you didn't grow up in how, figure out a way to make this part of your marriage, something that you can talk about, that you can win together, have goals and dreams and desires together for this vital part of your relationship, right? Make we, ours, and us more of the priority in this part of your life together. And do the same thing. Do the same thing when it comes to your free time. Right? Make we, ours, and us more of a priority when it comes to your free time, when it comes to your hobbies and to your interests, when it comes to your calendar and the schedule that you keep, and when it comes to planning of the guys' trips and the girls' trips and the vacations that you take and the in-laws that you visit, right? You got to make we, ours, and us the priority as often as you can. You gotta fight for each other. You gotta advocate for each other. You gotta help meet the needs of each other, because you're trying to win together, right? Love does not seek itself. It does not demand its own way. Me has to die. In the marriage relationship, me has to die. Ego has to die. Self-centeredness has to die, right? Your demand to be right all the time and to win all the time, it has to die so that we can win and live and thrive together. And here's what's great about this, right? You're not giving up anything. Right? You're not conceding anything. You're not conceding victory. You don't have to worry that you know, you're not going to get your fair shake in this deal. When we and ours and us, you know, when that's the priority, when you're fighting for we, ours, and us, when each of you is advocating for the other and for the we, when each is committed to meeting the needs of the other and the needs you have as a couple, right? When each of you are committed to the other and to the marriage relationship, your needs are still met wherever it is, and you start winning together. And small wins are contagious, and you start saying, man, this is great, and you want to keep winning together, and you do, and God and the other are often honored more so along the way. Imagine if this was truly the everyday priority for more of our marriages, right? The marriages that exist now or the marriages that might exist someday. Imagine if more marriages here at Midcurrent were not characterized by a love that demanded its own way and that was not self-seeking and looking out for itself and constantly going back into the corner to come out swinging again. Imagine if it was characterized by a love that wasn't looking out for itself most of all, but that was most concerned with the object of its love. I think we'd have healthier marriages. We'd have happier homes. We'd be better examples to our kids. There'd be less fighting. There'd be fewer tug of wars constantly in our home. I think there'd be a massive decrease in resentment and bitterness and jealousy and envy that comes when each person is just fighting for themselves. It's just fighting for me rather than we. Not only do I want that to be the case, this kind of marriage, not only do I want that to be the case for my marriage and for your marriage, I want that for you, I want that for us, I want that for me, but I want to live in a world where this is the picture of marriage for all to see, that this is the picture of marriage that we paint for the world, a picture of the incredible love that God actually has for us, that God has for humanity. See, what if this is how more marriages operated here? Imagine the joy and the satisfaction. Imagine the accomplishment. Imagine the sense of pride that we would feel in each victory that you'd feel in each victory that you experience together. Imagine the message. If this was our marriages, your marriage, my marriage, more marriages here, imagine the message those marriages would send to the world. Imagine the picture that our marriages could be to the world of God's love for them, a love that was so strong that he was willing to send Jesus to die so that we could live. What if our marriage, if it is supposed to be, if it could be a picture, what if that's the message that we send? So let's work. Here's my thought. Let's work. Let's work for a marriage that not only works for each other, but let's work for a marriage that reminds the world of that kind of love that exists for them. I think it happens when love does not demand its own way, when it does not seek itself, and when more of us commit to this idea that me has got to die so that we can win and we can live and we can thrive and we can be a big, bright, shining example of God's love for all the world to see. Let me pray for us. God, we got to start there in this conversation. God, we got to acknowledge how good you are, and we got to acknowledge the unfathomable love that you have for us, that you truly would send your son Jesus to die so that we could live, so that we could win in this life that we are living. God, if there are those of us here who haven't accepted that love, who haven't accepted that free gift that you offered to us, God, we got to start there, right? We cannot give to someone else what we have not accepted from you, God. So we give you thanks that you were the one that first demonstrated this kind of love. And God, if there are those of us here that need to raise our hands and say yes to that, I pray that now would be a moment. Now would be the moment to accept the gift of your amazing love for us. And God, for those of us who have already accepted it, God, for those of us who are already so grateful for it, would you help us to demonstrate it more, to live it out more every day? God, everywhere we go, but specifically as we talk about marriages, would you help us to demonstrate that kind of love more in our marriage relationship, God, and over the, you know, during the car ride home today, or you know, over lunch or over the dinner table, God, would you just be so present in the conversations that happen between husbands and wives today, God, and would you help them graciously, God, would you help them to see where we, ours and us, could be? Maybe it's the one spot, God, would you help each marriage here and each marriage in the future, God, would you help each one to see where it is that we, ours and us, needs to be more of a priority. So God, help us to love better and to honor the other and to honor you more each and every single day. So grateful for you, God, for your love for us. And we pray all these things in your name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this week's message from Midcurrent Church. For more information and to visit us online, check out midcurrentchurch.org and find us on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us online during the week and visit us on Sunday mornings at 9 and 10:30 a.m. at 200 First Street in downtown Hudson.